is not extremely lengthy. It's not like trying to do an overview of the entire Bhagavad Gita in 4 weeks, which we sometimes do. We have 18 mantras and one invocation mantra, so there's 19 mantras or verses altogether that we have to study, plus Prabhupada's introduction, that we have to study over the next 9 days. So hopefully we'll get through it all. You'll be graded, of course, at the end. The grade will be based mainly on the test. Also, we'll be taking into consideration attendance. We can just start, seeing we don't have a tremendous amount of time. Let us start by turning in our overview book, turning to page 2. The heading there is Editor's Preface. And here we've just given just a very simple type of summary, you could say, of what we're going to be, what Ishapanishad is all about, what the subject matter is. In a nutshell. And in the first paragraph, we have given a little explanation of a contextual nature. What is Ishapanishad? Where does it fit in the scheme of the Vedic literatures? So we explain here that the Vedic literatures have a number of main subdivisions. First of all, there's the four Vedas, the Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva, with their corollaries, including the Upanishads. Then another subdivision, the Upanishads, in a sense, then are a subdivision of the subdivision of the, like, the total or complete Vedic literature. The Upanishads are a subdivision of the subdivision, which is the four Vedas. Then another major subdivision is the Puranas. And amongst the Puranas, the main one is Srimad Bhagavatam, most important of all the Puranas. And of course, we are all familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam very well. And then there, another main subdivision is the Itihasas. Itihasa means history. So within the overall sort of umbrella of the Vedic literatures as a whole, these are three of the main subdivisions. Four Vedas, then the Puranas, then the histories. And within the histories, the main histories, or practically these are the histories. As far as I know, there aren't really other histories. There's Ramayana and Mahabharata. And of course, Bhagavad Gita is part of Mahabharata. So, just
put a little scheme on the board. We have four Vedas. And they have subdivisions, Aranyakas,
and the Upanishads. There's another division. Anyone remember the other fourth part? Brahmana, Aranyaka. I forget. There's a fourth one, subdivision. Oh, the Samhitas. Actually, let me just... Samhita should go at the top. So you have your Samhita, Samhitas, four Vedas. The four Vedas are divided up
into these four sections. Samhitas. Samhitas means those parts of the four Vedas which are explaining about the different goals that you can achieve, mainly through Karmakandiya. You can go to this place, that place, and the glories of all these different places and the glories of going to those places. Then the Brahmanas explain about the sacrifices, Karmakandiya sacrifices, which are involved in achieving these places which are described and the different achievements which are described in the Samhitas. The Aranyakas, they give more detailed descriptions about the sacrifices and different aspects of the arrangements that are required for the sacrifices. And the Upanishads explain the philosophy behind all of this. So the Upanishads are very philosophical. So that's one division, and then actually, strictly speaking, the Puranas and the Itihasas, or histories, these are grouped together, actually. They're grouped together. So we did say that there are three main subdivisions. Actually, there are really two main subdivisions, and these two are connected together. They're mainly historical, as you would know from attending many a Srimad Bhagavatam class, I'm sure, that Srimad Bhagavatam is full of narrations about different people and what they did. So, historical nature. But in terms of being historical records, the Puranas are a little eclectic, would be the right word, but it's not like you've got one Purana, any Purana, and it's telling one whole history from beginning to end, which is the case with the Itihasas, Ramayana, and Mahabharata, which are telling one story. Ramayana, of course, is the story of Lord Ram from beginning to end. That's what Ramayana is. And Mahabharata is the story of the Pandavas, basically, and, you know, their family sort of history and their fortunes and all that. But the Puranas, in a historical sense, are more eclectic, if you know what I mean by that. All different stories from all different times and places and circumstances and people, obviously to make different, certain specific important points. So they're historical in nature, but they're very much all the different little small stories which make up a Purana, they're establishing certain very important points. Like in the Bhagavatam class now, we're reading about Prahlad Maharaj. So that's historical. But there's a point there that Prahlad was such a great devotee that even though he was 5 years old, he was extremely young, but because he was such a great devotee, even though he was placed in the most impossible circumstances, but Krishna saved him, and he came out unscathed by the mercy of Krishna. So there's a point there that we should depend on Krishna. And Krishna will save us if we really take shelter of him. Or like in the story of Dhruva Maharaj, the point there is that, I guess in the end, the point is that nothing material, even the best material thing, because he wanted to get the whole universe, or even more than the whole universe, actually, a kingdom bigger than Brahma's. And Brahma's kingdom means the entire universe. So he really had some big material desires. But when he realized Krishna, then he realized that all these material things are just useless. So that is the point there. So there are 18 Puranas. There are 6 in each mode. Then there's 18 subsidiary or Upa Puranas. Then there's 18 Alpa Puranas, which are like subsidiary or something like that. So in this way, the Vedic literature is a very simple sort of scheme. But this gives us an idea of what the Vedic literatures, how they're structured. So Ishapanishad, where does Ishapanishad fit in? Did everyone mark themselves present, incidentally? Anyone still need it? Anyone not mark themselves? Sorry. Can you just pass this back? There's one Mataji back there. Present. So if we look in the second paragraph of our editor's preface in the overview book, we refer to Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, chapter 7, verse 108. Those of you who have read Chaitanya Charitamrita, you may remember this purport. Prabhupada lists out all the Puranas, 108. I mean, all the Upanishads, sorry. 108 Upanishads. Actually, there are more. I've heard from, might be the right term, some Vedic scholars have told me that the idea is that each Samhita has its Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishad. And I forget the number. It's something like, anyway, there's thousands, many, many, should I say, according to the Vedas, what is left is maybe another thing. But according to the Vedas, there are more Samhitas in the Vedas than are currently existing. Thank you. Thousands and thousands. And each Samhita, I think there's something like 100,000 Samhitas. Each Samhita has a Brahmana, an Aranyaka, and an Upanishad. Now, we have left only 108 Upanishads that are popularly accepted as being bona fide. 108. And in that list that Srila Prabhupada gives in Chaitanya Charitamrita, we find that the Sri Ishapanishad is the first of the Upanishads. So it is very, very important amongst the Upanishads, according to none other than Sripad Shankaracharya. We're generally not great fans of Shankaracharya. But anyway, for what it's worth, and I must say, this particular idea is generally accepted by Vaishnavas also. He says that there are 11 of those 108 Upanishads which are the most important. And in fact, in that purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada also makes the same point. He lists out the first 11. So there's 11 which are the most important, and Ishapanishad is the most important of those, or the first of those. Like you may have heard of Mundaka Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. These are some of that first group of 11, which is said to be the most important. And Ishapanishad's the first, so it's very, very important. And we make the point here that it is very important in that it gives fundamental definitions of many of the most important aspects of Vedic knowledge. So as we go through Ishapanishad, you'll see that in effect, Ishapanishad is practically giving a very concise, of course, it's all very concise and succinct and very much to the point, but the Ishapanishad is giving a very nice summary of our whole Vaishnava philosophy. Very, very nice, actually.
who is God, what is our position, what to do, what not to do, and how to achieve the goal of life, the perfection of life. This is one of the occupational hazards of having our classes here, the children. Anyway, that's okay. So Ishapanishad is giving very succinct summary of all the main elements in our philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada's purports are very, very wonderful. Actually, the text itself is very wonderful, particularly at the end. The speaker, I don't know who the speaker is, in fact, but the speaker, the last about four verses or so, very, very beautiful verses, as he's very humbly throwing himself at the lotus feet of the Lord and begging for some mercy at the end of his life. So Ishapanishad, the texts, the mantras are very, very nice, very important philosophically, and Prabhupada's purports are also very important and very, very nice. Prabhupada really elaborately comments on each text, on each mantra. You know, normally when you go through Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, there are lengthy purports occasionally, but generally the purports are not so long. To get a purport longer than one page would be a little unusual, perhaps, something like that. But here we find practically every purport is 3 pages, 4 pages, some of them are 6 or 7 pages. So Srila Prabhupada really goes into the subject matter of each verse quite elaborately. And as always, in bringing out very wonderful and very important and very essential points. So let's just continue on in the editor's preface. Now we are going to give a little, very, very brief summary of the subject matter. The nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is described. How everything spiritual and material and how everything spiritual and material is related with him. Then it explains that to be aware of this, or to be Krishna conscious, is the platform for a successful, happy life. Whereas ignorance of Krishna, and ignorance of Krishna's plan in any form, and the speaker of Ishapanishad describes certain of the main types of ignorance, So ignorance of Krishna and his plan in any form will lead to disaster. The speaker of Ishapanishad doesn't mince his words at all. He really, when he wants to make the point that something is undesirable or quite undesirable, he smashes. He uses what Prabhupada would call, or Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the chopping technique. He just smashes them to pieces. Yes, so ignorance of Krishna's plan will lead to disaster. But if one dedicates one's life to understanding and realizing Krishna, in other words, the process of devotional service, then by Krishna's mercy, he may reveal himself to the sincere devotee, and then one can go back to Godhead. One can perfect one's life. So all this is graphically described in Sri Ishapanishad, culminating in the speaker's heartfelt surrender at the lotus feet of the Lord and his appeal for the Lord's supreme mercy. So even though the Upanishads are generally known for being somewhat impersonal in their presentation, we find that Sri Ishapanishad is very clearly presenting the absolute truth as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the process for approaching him to be bhakti, or devotional service. So that, in a nutshell, and that's a very small nutshell, but in a nutshell, that is actually the message of Sri Ishapanishad, the framework, you could say, of Sri Ishapanishad. And as we say, it is interesting, as we've mentioned here, it's very interesting that the Upanishads generally, those of you who have read a little extensively Srila Prabhupada's books, you will have come across a number of statements in which Srila Prabhupada refers to the Upanishads, or in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya himself refers to the Upanishads as being very philosophical and somewhat impersonal. Somewhat impersonal. But, of course, we know that all of the Vedic literatures, even those parts of the Vedic literatures which superficially appear impersonal, but they're all part of the process. It's like a systematic process by Vyasadeva to bring us ultimately to the lotus feet of Krishna. The thing is that in the very early stages, and four Vedas and with their corollaries means the earlier stages of a person's development. The four Vedas and their corollaries are, at least according to the traditional concept of what the Vedas are and how you approach the Vedas. So the four Vedas and their corollaries, they're more introductory. They're essentially, at least the Samhitas themselves, which are the main substance, like in a quantitative sense, the Samhitas are quite lengthy. So the Samhitas, as I understand, they're virtually all Karmakandya. And when we refer to the, in the eighth offense, in the chanting of the holy names of the Lord, that one may think that the Hare Krishna, chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, is like, you know, the same sort of thing as what is being described in the Karmakandiya section of the Vedas. Karmakandiya section of the Vedas essentially means the four Vedas, but particularly the Samhitas and the Brahmanas and Aranyakas, which are intimately connected with the Samhitas, all about the demigods and the glories of the higher planetary systems, and then how you can achieve them like this. So the four Vedas are really like, in a very traditional sense of how people would approach life in terms of the Vedas, the four Vedas, they're pretty much the Karmakandiya section, other than the Upanishads. And they're where people would begin. And then when they would advance a bit more, they would come to the Itihasas, and then the Puranas, and then finally Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the cream, the ripened fruit of the tree of Vedic knowledge. So the Upanishads then are part of that first section of the overall Vedic literatures, the four Vedas, they're part. In fact, Ishapanishad is part of Atharva Veda, of these four Vedas, Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva. The Ishapanishad is part of the Atharva Veda, I think it is. It's mentioned in the Ishapanishad, Sam. So, because the four Vedas, being the beginning part of the Vedic literatures, they're more intended for beginners and people who will be contaminated in different ways, including having impersonal tendencies. So the Upanishads are designed more for people like that. So it's not difficult to interpret Upanishads, even Ishapanishad, in certain respects at least. Certain of the verses could be interpreted impersonally. But actually they're part of this greater presentation of all the Vedic literatures, culminating in Srimad Bhagavatam. So ultimately they're referring to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Srila Prabhupada, the way he translates and comments on Ishopanishad, he really brings out the fact that Ishopanishad, as the main or one of the main, at least certainly the first Upanishad, is really pointing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada's very expert at doing that, bringing out the real essence. In fact, one devotee asked Prabhupada one time, he had just read one verse, the devotee had read one verse, and had looked through the word for word, and seen in the translation itself that Srila Prabhupada had put the name Krishna, that the verse was referring to Krishna. But when the devotee looked at the word for word, he couldn't find Krishna as such. So he asked Srila Prabhupada that, you know, like suggesting that, is it a mistake? You've put Krishna in, perhaps he wasn't meant to be there. But Srila Prabhupada replied that, no, this is my expertise. Krishna is there. Actually, even though, you know, in a very sort of superficial sense, he might not appear to be there in very specific terms, but actually he's definitely there. In fact, he's everywhere in the Vedic literatures, of course. So he's definitely there. And Prabhupada said, that's my expertise, that I can show you actually how Krishna is there. Otherwise, these people who are like what Srila Prabhupada would refer to as ABC translators. These ABC translators, because Sanskrit is a language, and like any language, French or German or whatever it might be, you can learn it if you want. So if you're going to be an ABC translator, then it's very difficult to really get the essence. So, but with such an extremely advanced devotee as Srila Prabhupada, he is very nicely showing us in Ishopanishad how Krishna is there and is actually not just there, but is completely the focal point. So now let us see. I think what we'll do now is go on to the introduction. So the introduction, we've given a little summary on page 3 of the overview book. You can turn to that also. In fact, this overview book, as you go through, you'll see we give a little summary of each verse, of each mantra. This is basically, it's like a little precis, you could say, a very brief condensation of the main points which are appearing in each verse, or in this case, in the introduction. The introduction is in the form of a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, which he gave on his first visit to London in 1969. Famous lecture. So I've summarized it here. Like the first paragraph of our summary on page 3 of the overview book is a couple of pages, actually, of the introduction as it appears in the book. Pretty much, let's see, first 3.5 pages we've attempted to summarize in the first paragraph. I mean, this is really in a nutshell, of course, but that's what it's meant to be. Let's just go through the first 3.5 pages then, which we've summarized in the first paragraph there. So we are saying that Prabhupada begins by explaining the standing that the Vedas have, how important the Vedas are, and how we should view them. And how, whereas mundane knowledge is always defective, but Vedic knowledge is always free from the different defects which are there in mundane knowledge. So
Srila Prabhupada, for the first couple of pages, talks about the defects. You should know there are four defects of a conditioned soul. Who can tell us what is one defect? Put your hand up and... Yes, Brahma? Sorry? Huh? Oh, to cheat others. Right, exactly. Thank you. Wait. I'll get someone else. One of the Matajis? Yeah. Imperfect senses. Yeah. Tendency to commit mistakes. Being illusioned. Right. So these are the four classic defects. And if we analyze all the defects and shortcomings that people have, we'll see they fit under these four headings. And Srila Prabhupada explains these four defects very nicely with very nice examples. The first one in the first paragraph is the tendency to commit mistakes, to err as human. And Srila Prabhupada gives a very vivid example, the example of so-called Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas K. Gandhi. So Mr. Gandhi, so-called Mahatma, you know, there was one Australian journalist, said that Mr. Gandhi is a very unusual person. He's either a saint amongst the politicians or a politician amongst the saints. Kind of enigmatic character. But common people who don't know very much at all, they were very impressed with Mr. Gandhi. So these common, ordinary people, they gave him this title, Mahatma, which has stuck. But Srila Prabhupada, in fact, just a few days ago, I was with one devotee in South Africa, and he was making a big compilation of Prabhupada's statements about Gandhi. There are hundreds. And Srila Prabhupada really didn't appreciate Mr. Gandhi very much. I mean, really. He actually speaks extremely strongly against Mr. Gandhi. So anyway, here Prabhupada is using Mr. Gandhi as an example, that on the day that he was assassinated, he was warned. In fact, what had happened is that, I think the day before, if I remember correctly, the day before, the same group of people who actually killed him eventually, the day before, they tried to kill him also, but they made a mistake. Their idea was that there was this garden in between his residence and the place, little temple or whatever, where they would hold the prayer meeting. And he would walk at a set time from this residence to the temple through this garden, kind of open grassy area. So their idea was that from outside the garden, from behind the wall, they would just lean over the wall and shoot him. But they made a mistake. They didn't check it out in advance. And the wall was too high. So the fellow tried to climb up the wall and sort of hang on to the wall and shoot over the top, but it didn't work. And he fell, actually. And there was a guard or some person hanging around at a little distance away. And this fellow fell and a bit of a commotion. So the guard came running over to see if he was all right. And he left the gun and ran. So the guard found the gun the day before. So they knew that there was an assassination attempt was there. And at the time of the prayer meeting, to try and get him when he's walking between the buildings, they knew that. So they warned him that maybe today, don't go to the prayer meeting. Or you can have your prayer meeting in the residence, but don't go outside today. And then Gandhi thought about it, and he thought, well, no, I'll go to the prayer meeting. So he walked out, and this time, the same fellow was even more bold. He just walked up to him, face to face, and went, namaskar, holding the gun in his hands. Namaskar, took the gun, and from about 1 meter away, shot him. And that was that. That was the end of Mr. Gandhi for this lifetime. So he made a mistake. Even though he's a big, big man, and even to this day he's revered by so many people. But he made a mistake, and it was a fatal mistake. So, very nice example of that. Then, next defect Prabhupada talks about in the second paragraph in the introduction in the book is to be illusioned. And what example does Prabhupada give? Like, classic example of what the implication of being illusioned is. The fact that we think that we're this body. We all think that we're these bodies. Everyone thinks that they are their body. And life in the material world is going on that basis. This is a very classic example of being illusioned. Then the third defect is the cheating propensity. And here Srila Prabhupada gives the example of people who take the position of being materialistic intellectuals or teachers, even though they, as already stated, even though they make mistakes, even though they're in illusion, but still they'll get up in front of an audience and try and explain reality their way. So this is cheating. In fact, Srila Prabhupada made the point that the word cheat and the word teach are very similar. You just take the T and the CH and switch them around. And teaching becomes cheating. You know, like some of you may even have experienced when you're at school, that they may have taught you about the theory of evolution, but not, they didn't teach you about how it's a theory. They more or less taught you that about the so-called reality of evolution. This is cheating, simply cheating. And then lastly, Srila Prabhupada says on page 7 in the middle of the page, lastly we have imperfect senses. And Prabhupada gives a very good example about our sense of sight. We all have eyes. And someone may challenge us that I have eyes and you're talking about God, so show me God so I can see him with my eyes. And if we then say, well, look, I can't right here and now, I can't show you God, then they may think, aha, we caught you out. You couldn't show me God. So therefore, they may think they've disproved our idea. But Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice example. Do you have the eyes, the type of eyes required to see God? So the defect is not that we can't show. In a sense, we can show. But the defect is yours, that you haven't got the eyes to see. If we did show. And Prabhupada explains that if you're in a room, at night at least, if you're in a room and the lights are on, and suddenly someone just switches off the lights, then you can't see anything. You can't even see yourself. You can't even see your hand. You can't see a thing. Because your eyes are not suited for that. But if your eyes are different, like I heard cats. Can cats see at night? I heard that. Something like that. They have some sort of little more developed sense of sight, so they're more easily able to see. Or if you have, there's certain types of glasses that soldiers use, I know, like in the more advanced armies in the world, and rifle sights, that you look through these glasses, and even though it's night, you can see more or less. At least you can see the basic shapes that are there. Or a rifle sight, you can look down and you can see. So by adjusting the circumstances, then you may get the eyes to see. So to see God is not an ordinary thing. There's so many things we can't see. We can't see the air, which is here filling the space between us, which we're all breathing and we're all totally dependent on for our lives. But we cannot see it. We've never seen it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada establishes the point that we cannot be relied upon as sources of information on the basis of our own capabilities and capacities. We cannot be depended on. But the Vedas can be depended upon because they don't have those shortcomings. This Srila Prabhupada discusses for about the next page or so, from the bottom of page 7 of the introduction to about, let's see, say about the bottom of page 8 or thereabouts. One way that Srila Prabhupada addresses, it's an interesting way Srila Prabhupada establishes that the Vedas, as a source of information, are better than we are with our defective senses and so on. Srila Prabhupada gives a couple of examples of things which we come across, particularly as devotees, and you could say Indian people, they also come across these things very frequently, which according to our sense of perception, our senses, and you know, our normal capacities for evaluating and understanding things. Prabhupada gives two examples of things which, according to that system, we would immediately think they're no good, they're bad, and they should be avoided. Cow stool and conch shell. According to our senses, cow stool, of course, is stool, and everyone knows that stool is completely untouchable and totally undesirable. So cow stool, by so-called normal circumstances, everyone would just write off cow stool as being just another type of stool which we don't need. But actually cow stool is extremely pure. It's so pure, it's purifying. It's very remarkable. And that is described in the Vedas. Actually, it can be also seen by, you know, if you do an experiment scientifically, you can come to that conclusion. But by smell or, you know, looking at it, the average person would conclude just on the surface that cow stool is just another type of undesirable stool. But it's not. And similarly, conch shell. Conch shell is bone. And bone is very contaminating. If you handle bones, then you'll find that your hands get filthy very, very quickly. Because that's just the way bone is. It's just the way bone is. It's not exactly like you can clean it and then it'll be okay. It's bone is like intrinsically dirty, very, very dirty. So conch shell, it's bone. And the average person would think, oh, bone is dirty, conch shell is bone, so conch shell is dirty. But no. And again, it can be shown scientifically that conch shell is pure. And that is stated in the Vedas. So, of course, Srila Prabhupada here doesn't go elaborately into the subject from the point of view, like, say, that the Vedas are coming from Krishna, and Krishna's perfect, therefore the Vedas are perfect. He doesn't really approach it so much, not so much from that point of view, but he approaches it by giving these two interesting examples, that the Vedas contain knowledge which is perfect. And they are a better source of knowledge than we are.
And then he gives these examples to illustrate this fact. It's very nice. And to sort of illustrate it further, in the paragraph right towards the bottom of page 8, Prabhupada gives like a social example that in India, even to this day, amongst some circles perhaps, that if people want to, if they're arguing on some subject, if one of them can get up and say, well, my point of view is supported in the Vedas, then it's based, that's the end of the argument. That will be accepted because the Vedas, the fact that the Vedas in so many ways explain things which are beyond our senses, but actually they're true, and they can be shown to be true. Therefore, the Vedas are taken extremely seriously by people who are familiar with them and who have gone through them and put them to the test. So we can also accept them. This is the approach that Prabhupada is taking to establish the validity or the importance of the Vedas. And going on to the second paragraph now in the overview book, we talk about Shabda, we talk about the Acharyas. This is discussed. Actually, I think we'll just go on with this tomorrow. So why don't you all read the introduction tonight? Is that okay? And just see how the points that, as we've taken them out in the overview book, how they're fitting in, how they're being more elaborately described in Srila Prabhupada's lecture in the introduction. And we'll go on with that tomorrow. Any comments or questions so far?
It's mentioned in that there is three kinds of evidences, Satya, Anuman, and Sabda. What is Anuman?
Anuman means inference. Inference. To infer something. Like, what is the classic one? That somebody, man is mortal, somebody, was it Socrates or? Socrates is a man, so Socrates is mortal. This is called a syllogism in logic, in philosophy, a syllogism. Three-step process of establishing something. Man is mortal. Socrates is a man, so Socrates is mortal. So that's inferring. Now, we have not met Mr. Socrates, so we may not, have put it to the test and proved it. I suppose to prove it, you'd have to kill him. Otherwise, you wouldn't necessarily know whether he was mortal or not. But inference means that he's a man, and that type, men, they're mortal. That is our experience. So therefore we conclude, it's inferred that Socrates is... Yes. Every fire produces smoke. There is smoke. There is a fire, even though you may not see the fire.
Challenge that. So what is the best way of dealing with the question?
For who? They want to know who wrote them?
Yeah. Sometimes we use this argument logically to present the Socrates that's the very superior to them. Superior in that sense. No greatest. So we have to present the other day.
Yes. Well, you know, who wrote Huckleberry Finn? Who wrote Huckleberry Finn?
Mark Twain.
Oh, yes. Someone in the airplane the other day was reading Huckleberry Finn. I happened to notice. So Mark Twain So, I mean, they haven't met Mark Twain. They're just accepting it on that, you know, through the last 100 or however many years. Everyone has accepted that Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn. So we say, not only we say, but so many people say, Vyasadeva himself says that he wrote or compiled the Vedas. So, I mean, why would there be, other than that there's more time involved, which doesn't really make any difference necessarily at all, why would we think that it's less likely to be true that Vyas compiled the Vedas than that Mark Twain compiled or wrote Huckleberry Finn? I mean, it's just a matter of prejudice, actually. That's the problem. It's an attitude problem on their part. They'll accept Mark Twain. They won't even question it. Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn. But the Vedas, no, 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 Vyasadeva, no. They won't accept. Anyway, like I said, Srila Prabhupada here is not elaborately exploring the subject. But he's just using, it's a very clever method he uses. That in the Vedas, you find certain pieces of information. These are just two examples. They're not the only examples, by any means. In the Vedas, you find certain statements that this is like this. Now, according to your direct perception and so on, it doesn't appear to be like that. Cow stool. It's stool. So according to your direct perception, it seems to be bad. But the Vedas say, no, it's very, very good. But then you test it scientifically and you see, actually, it is good. So there are many examples in the Vedas like that. Yeah. And this is the method that Prabhupada's using. And it's not really my intention to really go into, like, trying to justify, so to speak, the way, or the Vedas. But this is, in a nutshell, the bottom line, really. One of the Mataji's had their hands up. Well, I don't think we would bring it up, you know, too quickly in our discussion with them. I mean, what would be the point? What would be the point? You know, if we're trying to impress it on them, get them to, you know, accept this, that would probably be, even though it's true, from a sort of political point of view or whatever, from the point of view of argument, it would be a very weak, a very sort of, like a badly thought out type of argument. Even though it's true, you'd be going against, arguing against yourself, in effect. Yeah. So, yes, you're right. It's pretty fantastic. You have to already have, you know, accepted it. Then for a devotee, you tell them, oh, Vyasadeva's living in the Himalayas. Oh, okay, fine. What's next? But, the, you know, some man in the street or materialistic intellectual or someone like that who's in there. Even Bhaktivinod Thakur, who was the first of our acharyas to really take up the mission of preaching to Westerners. There are certain writings of his in which he, of course, he's trying to establish Krishna consciousness, but certain things which somehow or other, it's like he can't avoid mentioning them, but they're quite fantastic. So in some cases, in some of his writings, he says that they're mythological. Yeah. So now, obviously, we don't think that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is in illusion like that, but it's some special consideration because his audience then, you know, is much worse than even the audiences we would meet now, who we would consider bad. They were much worse.
Upa Puranas and Alpha Puranas.
No, Bhagavat Purana and Srimad Bhagavatam are essentially the same thing.
Yeah. So is it the number, say?
It's 18.
The number 18?
Yeah. You'll find that our acharyas, like if you read through Tattva Sandarbha,
Jiva Goswami is discussing the position of Srimad Bhagavatam. So he's frequently referring to it as the Bhagavat Purana. And even in Srimad Bhagavatam itself, sometimes it refers to itself as the Bhagavat Purana.
His question is it one of the 18, or is it like 10?
No, it's one of the 18. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the six in the mode of goodness. Of course, it's in pure goodness, beyond goodness. But in material terms, the best you could say about it is that it's in the mode of goodness. In material terms. Okay, so read the introduction, please, and we'll discuss the rest of it tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.